are excited to do a new series, and this series is called Jesus Encounters. Jesus Encounters. And the idea is that as we live missionally, as we are going about our day-to-day lives, we're encountering people from a diverse set of backgrounds. Interestingly enough, Jesus encountered people from a diverse set of backgrounds. And we read through the Gospels, you will see many of these encounters, and each one of them has a fascinating story about how Jesus interacted with them. And we thought, over the next 6-8 weeks, we're going to explore some of these encounters. We're going to look at how Jesus dealt with certain situations that he came across, especially as it relates to people, as it relates to people. And so rather than say, you know, Jesus meets a royal official, we want to get right to the heart of the matter and note that what was it in that encounter that we need to unpack? And so today, I am going to kick this off by starting with this text of John 4, 46 to 54, and talk about Jesus encounters desperation. Sorry, Joy, I'm not there yet. You can go back. Jesus encounters desperation. We find people at times that are in desperate situations. Now, as a pastor, I'm in the kind of scenario where I meet desperation. Quite often. Oftentimes it's maybe in a funeral setting or at a deathbed of somebody, and they just don't know what to do. They're at a loss. I've had parents say to me, I've had parents come to me and say, "Can you please come to our house?" And they say, "What's up?" "My mother passed away, and I can't tell the kids. I don't know how to tell the kids. I can't tell them," and they're just desperate. I can't, you need to come and tell the kids. And so I have to walk in and come alongside this family who don't know how to express this loss and say to kids, your grandma passed away. Or I've done this in the case of somebody where their mom passed away or some tragedy has happened, and there's just that sense of desperation. And last night we had such a beautiful illustration. These three guys that Doug had mentioned, these young men, Blessing, Lion Peter, and Narward, three guys, and each one of them shared their story, and your heart just breaks. You know, and what caught me off guard was this. You know, there was a, back in the day, you know, the singing traveling groups, the singing families and stuff, we used to have them scoot through town and they'd show up at church and they'd be all out there and sing the Gaither type music or something like that. And they, you know, there was always, I remember one group came to Abbotsford and the guy sat down on the piano and he just, you know, they started playing and he was saying, "Well, let me tell you about my testimony." And he started playing the piano. And he goes, "I was into drugs. I was addicted, hopelessly addicted. I was stealing stuff. I was lying. I was being rebellious." And he was going on. He goes, "Then at the age of 5, I gave my heart to Jesus." You know, oh, funny, funny, funny. I mean, it was a bit of a joke. And we've often sort of, that's been over the years in the church, I've heard that a few times, right, as a bit of a testimonial joke. But if you were here last night, I don't know if you caught this, but it really gripped my heart because it was no joke. One of the guys talked about his mom being the second wife of one guy, and I believe it was in Burundi, and he was there, and it was difficult. The mom and the dad got divorced, and he was with his mom, and then she decided this wasn't going to work. She gave him back to the dad, said, "You have to look after him." She took off and went to another country. And he had to stay in the home, and his stepmother was the evil stepmother. She would insult him, he said. She would hurt him. She would not feed him. Like, just, he was picked on. He was forced into hard labor. And he was sharing this story, right? And then he finally said, "I couldn't take it anymore, and I ran away." And he goes, and then all of a sudden it hits me. He was 6 years old. 6 years old, and he ran away and went to the other country to find his mom. Found her. She had remarried, but because of her remarriage, she saw her son as a threat to the security of her new marriage and said, "You have to leave. I don't want any part of you." And he was kicked away from her. And so at 7 years old, he said he's about 7 years old, he ends up a life on the street. That, my friends, is desperation. where do I go? I have nowhere to turn. And praise the Lord for a couple that were Christians that found him on the streets and took him in and said, we'll help you. You can stay with us. And they fed him and they got him a little bit of work. They looked after him and he was able to be looked after. And he was really thrilled about that. And for a number of years, that was beautiful until a tragedy hit that home and they lost everything and he had to leave again. And that's when he found the Village of Hope and it changed his life. But not only that, of course, in the context, in the situation of all that, he came to faith in Jesus Christ. Desperate situations, desperate times. Desperation is that place where you don't know what the options are anymore. You just don't know where to turn. And I probably, in my ministry, probably where it hit me the hardest was as just a young pastor. I was 25, 20, maybe 26, something like that. And so like Pastor Evan's age kind of thing. And we did a prayer service, and I was standing in this aisle, and this people were coming up for prayer, and this one couple came up, and they were on their way to the children's hospital. And I've told the story, so I won't gloss into it. But they came up with their little infant and said, our infant has leukemia, and we're on our way to the children's hospital. And we saw you were doing a service, and we walked in and saw that you were offering prayers. We just thought we'd come and get prayers. They weren't Christians. They were from a different faith, but they were just thinking we could come and get some prayers. See, that's desperation. Desperation is when you look at somebody who's got leukemia and you don't know what to do. And you say, what am I supposed to do in that situation, right? And I just concerned that when we're gathering and we're ministering to people, we are going to encounter situations of desperation. And I want to encourage you today from the scriptures of how Jesus handled it, that you actually can be ministering in those circumstances. You can be used of God in those times. You can come alongside people and you can help them. And we learn that, I think, through one of the greatest ways is just observe what Jesus did. How did Jesus handle it? So Jesus had a very similar story. It was a story of a man whose son was dying. And his son was on his deathbed. They were pretty certain he was not going to last much longer. And so they decided, what are we going to do? And so he goes off to find Jesus to ask him if he could pray for him. And here's the story. It's in John 4, and let's just read through it first, and then we'll get to a few ideas. So it says, once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned water into wine. So just said, this is early in the story, John, beginning of the book of John, and John has a way of referencing things. There was the first story of Cana was with the wedding, and Jesus turned water into wine. And John made a note that that was the first miracle. And then he goes on, and Jesus ends up in Jerusalem, and then he is on his way back from Jerusalem and gets all the way back into Cana, and he's once more back in Cana. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. And when this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son who was close to death. Jesus then replies to him, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never believe. You will never believe. You need to see something in order to believe, don't you? That's what he's saying to them. You guys really need to see something in order to wonder why are you going to put your faith into anything. So Jesus is commenting this way. I don't think it's a rebuke or anything. It's just a statement. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Go, Jesus replied. Your son will live. The man took Jesus at his word, and he departed. There's so much in just a few statements. He took him at his word and left. I mean, this story, you know, deserves to be unpacked. I wish I could have been there to see kind of how it all played out, but it's a story. We don't have a lot of room, so we're just going to pack this all into the nuts and bolts of it. And that was, he believed him, and he went back. And while he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, Like, obviously, there's some shock and there's some like, wow, hey, when did this happen? You know, and they said to him, yesterday at 1 p.m, the fever left him. Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and his whole household believed. This was the second sign Jesus performed after coming to Judea, from Judah to Galilee. So let's put this man's desperation into context, okay? How is this? Because the first thought that I was wondering as I looked at it, I immediately thought this is a story of desperation, but got to unpack it a bit. How is it a story of desperation? Like, where do we see that desperation? In such a short, compact story, you don't always get the emotional aspects of it, although most of us here could probably relate to what it would be like to imagine your son dying. And you can imagine finding what are we going to do. And you could just imagine that what was, can you not imagine what was going on in that home? Them talking and some servant coming in and saying, oh, hey, guess what? Jesus, remember the guy everybody was clamoring to see, the guy who turned water into wine and he was doing all those miracles and everything and he left. Well, he's back. The guys were just telling me he's in Cana and he's probably going to be doing some more stuff. And I could just picture, you know, his wife looking at him going, oh, we got to look at this. And the husband going, whoa, what are you? I know what you're thinking already. She goes, you know exactly what I'm thinking. Our son is going to die and that man does miracles. We're going to check that out. And let me put it more clearly. You're going to go and check this out. I'm going to stay here with our son. He's what are we going to do? Well, this is a royal official. This is a guy of prominence. This is not a guy who usually walks around and gets his own groceries kind of thing. This is a guy who has everything shipped to him. This is a guy who sends servants out to get things done. And in this case, here's a man who should not condescend. If anything, they should come to him. I was talking with our architect the other day, and we were talking about some stuff, and he was talking about the government's new initiatives for housing and development, right? And he said, they are so keen, so desperate, that they even came to my office. I looked at him and said, funny, and I thought that's a funny comment. He goes, you understand, the government never comes to our office. We always go to theirs. And I thought, interesting statement. And then I thought to myself, yeah, you know, in a case like this, this is a royal official. He doesn't go to your office. You go to his. He summons people. He doesn't go seek them out. So think about the desperation of a royal official feeling like, I don't care anymore. I'm going to go and find this guy. I'm going to go find this Jesus. I'm going to make him come home back here. So he condescends to begging. It even says that he begged Jesus, come back with me. He travels for hours. So he's in Capernaum, it says. Now, we're never quite exactly sure where Capernaum is. There's several different places where it could be. But most regards, it would be several hours by chariot. Several hours by vehicle, if you could call it that. It's up on the hillside. Cana's down by the Sea of Galilee. This is up to the west and up in the hills and country. And so he's got a bit of a journey. Probably take you all day if you walked it. But if he jumps on the horse and gallops or something, maybe he could get there quicker, 2, 3, 4 hours, somewhere along that line. So he's got a bit of a journey. So now you can even see the desperation. Have you ever been at the bedside of somebody you thought might die? And someone said to you, hey, why don't you go get a break? Hey, why don't you go get dinner? You know what? I was in that situation just the other day with somebody who's a young boy who's got leukemia and his mother's there. And I said, do you get a break? And she says, I don't eat. I don't wash my hair. I don't have a shower. I don't want to leave. I just don't care about anything. I'm just sitting right here. And I get that, especially at the beginning stages of an illness like that. You don't care, do you? You just don't. And I can imagine this official going, you want me to leave? He's probably going to die when I'm halfway there. And I missed out the last precious few hours of my son's life, and you want me to race off to Cana? That's how desperate it is that you'd be willing to forsake the last few hours of your life. And he betrays his own religious convictions because it's most likely that he was a Sadducee. So as you remember in the biblical stories, there's Pharisees and Sadducees, and these are the ruling leaders in the community. And the Sadducees were a larger group of people, but they were ones who didn't believe in eternal life or in resurrection. They are the ones who are very matter of fact. Life is just what it is. Life is just what it is. It happens. You don't question it. You don't worry about it. Fatalist. I don't know what the right word would be. Determinist. They were the kind of people that just have to take it in stride. And so here's a man who suddenly finds his son is dying, and everything within his upbringing says it's just the way it is, and yet he is unwilling to accept that. All of a sudden, his own values are called into question, and he decides, I know I should just be content with the fact that life is like this and my son's going to die, get over it, but I can't. Something can be done. There must be hope beyond this. And his own beliefs and values are betrayed as he pursues the seeking of Jesus to come and change the circumstance. So, desperate people. Let me identify a few things about these desperate people. And I want you to be aware of this, because when you encounter desperate people, keep these things in mind, okay? One is that desperate people are vulnerable. Desperate people are vulnerable. Okay, the official can easily be looked down by his peers. He's shaken all of his own values. He's no longer confident. He's wondering what to do. And Jesus could have embarrassed him. Jesus could have taken advantage of the situation. And when you're in those circumstances, you could also find yourself taking advantage of somebody who's vulnerable. And it's very important for you to remember that people in desperate circumstances are vulnerable. They're really exposed and feeling unsure about themselves. They may open up to you emotionally. They may show you a side of themselves that they've never let out. I've been in emotional circumstances with people who are, you know, burly and gruff, and they're always a bit tough, you know, and all of a sudden in a desperate situation, they're crying, weeping, and hugging me. That's unusual, but that's the vulnerability they have. They're being very emotional. They're out of their element now. And in that place, they become very vulnerable. And so it's important for us to keep in mind that they're vulnerable. They're also very demanding or aggressive. When people get desperate, if it's not even that kind of a circumstance, it might be in a hospital, or if you're a paramedic, or if you've been working in a trauma emergency ward, you know what it's like. People come in and they start snapping at you. They start telling you, you need to do something. Get over here right now. You know, just everything within them just becomes zeroed in, and they're not sensitive anymore. They don't care what's going on. They don't care what you're going through. They just want you to deal with this situation right now. Right? That's what's happening right there in the moment. And so people can be very aggressive. They can be demanding. And it's important for us to recognize that and not take it personally and not realize that, you know what, they're going through right now, they really don't know any better. And so don't react to that. Don't get caught up in that. You can just sit there for another hour then. You know, like, just don't, you know, this is just what's going on. It's just the way they're at. Do they need to be corrected? Do they need to be told to settle down? No. Politeness may go by the wayside. Don't hold that against them. They're in a place of desperation. And the desperate people are at a crossroads of belief. Everything that they valued, such as this Sadducee or this royal official, is shaken. And they're wondering, what's real? What do I believe in? And this could be a Christian who wonders, is God real? It could be a Christian who goes, where's God now? I thought God was supposed, you know, like all these questions come up. Or it could be a non-Christian. It could be someone from a different faith. It could be somebody who's secular. And they just go, I don't want God, or I don't care about God. And all of a sudden, in a place of desperation, they start going, hold on a minute. What is going on? All of a sudden, death's staring you in the face, and you start to wonder what's going on. All of a sudden, you're looking at being evicted out of your home because you have no money, and your bills are this high, and you're absolutely in a place of desperation, and you're sitting there going, what's going on? And you start to question your own beliefs. I thought I could handle anything, and suddenly I realize I can't. So desperate people are at a crossroads of belief. And that crossroad is not always a bad thing. It's oftentimes a great place where shifts can happen in your life, where things can change for the better. You can take on a different approach to things. And in this case, we see a story of a man who at this crossroads came to put his faith in Jesus and allowed the transformation to happen. And it ends the story with he and his family became followers of Christ. What a transformation occurred because of this story. So what do we learn from Jesus as he approaches the desperate people in the desperate situation? Again, I'm just going to list three things that we want to look at. Number one is be calm. Be calm. When people have had their lives turned upside down with something, their perspective gets thrown out the window. They are often in the exact opposite of calm. People who are desperate often lose the sense of calm within themselves. They're inside always trying to find how to find that place of stability and calmness, and they can't find it. And so outwardly, it's starting to show in the evidence, and maybe what they're doing is they're looking outside of themselves for something outside to calm them down. They're looking for a sense of calm that they can't find anymore within themselves. And so one of the first things we can do when we encounter desperation is just be calm. Just be chill. Don't panic. Just smile. Sometimes when people come to you, and honestly, like when I was praying for this young man and his wife and the little baby, I had no clue what is going to happen here. I don't know. But I just smiled. That's all. Just smile. Just take a moment. Wow. Just be calm. That is such a reassurance to people who are going through desperate times. And Jesus had amazing confidence. And we don't think about it with Jesus because he was Jesus. He was Son of God. So you never saw him in a tizzy. But recognize the fact that Jesus, of course, was always confident. He was always well-grounded, and he was always certain of who he was. This royal official comes to him. He's a royal official, so there's some influence. There's some, for most of us, if I don't know if, I'd say Justin Trudeau, but let's say maybe Andrew Scheer came here and said, oh, I need some help. I don't know what you're, but and you went, wow, this is like, a royal official. Sometimes everything goes out the window as you just get swallowed up in their story and you rush off and you go and you do whatever they need to do and you lose sight of what you are doing and who you are, When this royal official comes, Jesus could have said, oh, yeah, hey, guys, change of plans. We're going here. This is a royal official. He could be greatly influential in this area. We need to rush off and go seek him. And we don't ever see that in Jesus. And so it's important to recognize that it's consistent with his character, but it's still important in this story that Jesus was not caught up. He didn't get rattled. He wasn't thrown for a loop. He just knew who he was. I'm Jesus. I'm in Cana. And he probably had his devotions that morning. And he knew this is where God wanted him to be. And he was going to do some ministry here. And there was no sense in his heart that God was saying, you're going to go to Capernaum today. So this guy comes and he just goes, well, listen, in his mind he's thinking, I'm not going to Capernaum. But hey, he's just calm. He's relaxed. This is where I need to be right now. So your desperation, your turmoil that's all around there, I'm not going to allow that to suddenly be my turmoil. Don't take that turmoil on upon you. Just be calm. Many people have learned that when they've worked with addiction issues. If you go to Al-Anon or you go to a group, one of the things you're going to learn is that very important area of boundaries, right? Where, you're dealing with addiction. So people in addiction perceive themselves to always be desperate. Sometimes they actually are, and sometimes they just perceive themselves that way. It's just what they're going through. They just think, if it's a fix kind of thing, if I don't get another fix, I'm gonna die. And you go, well, you're not, but that's the desperation you're in. Or it might just be that your life is totally spiraled and fallen apart, and you know, because of some issues, and you right away just want to jump in and fix everything. You want to jump in there and take care of everything. Again, be calm. Don't immediately jump into people's desperation and take it on yourself. But we learn to put those boundaries in place. There's a need for that desperate person to have someone calm in their lives at that moment. Second was to be compassionate. The fact that Jesus takes any time at all with this guy is a sign of compassion. It's not always stated explicitly in the story, but it's implicit in how we see it transpire. And compassion is something that is oftentimes not talked about or described. It's oftentimes just inherent in the actions. Was Jesus compassionate to the woman at the well? Did it say, and Jesus had compassion on the woman at the well and said to her and sought to engage her in a conversation? It doesn't say what his motives were. It just says that he said, hey, could you get me a drink of water? The compassion is inherent in the fact that he had every reason to not engage the person, and he did. And then the village comes out. This is just preceding this story, where the whole village comes out. And the village comes out, and they're standing there, and Jesus looks, and his disciples come back, and they're like, oh, we need to just worry about ourselves right now, Jesus. We just need to worry about getting some food. We're hungry. We need to look after you. And Jesus says to them, listen, look at these people coming. They need someone to minister to them. This is more important than food. You know, there's an element of compassion in his decision-making. And other gospel writers in Mark and Matthew and Luke, they're very clear to point out the motivation of Jesus. And it says in numerous places, and he had compassion on them. And so he acted. He had compassion on them. When Jesus stoops down to a woman caught in adultery and the others are judging her and being harsh, and he treats her with respect and he treats her with dignity and he lifts her up out of her circumstances, was that not compassion? Do I have to say Jesus was compassionate? Or do his actions tell us that there is this compassion within him? And I believe his actions speak very loud and clear. And in this case, a royal official comes to him, and he could have even gone the other way. Hey, I have no interest in you guys because you're not helping anything. You're not, you know, you're politicians, and you're part of the problem, not the solution, and I don't want to help you. You know, no, there's to him, it's, I don't care if you're a royal official. You're a dad with a son who's hurting, and I want to talk to you. And so he takes the time to talk to him. That's compassion. And I believe that we need to have compassion. There are other forces that come out at the time. And that is part of the discipline we need to have in our lives, is to not always allow the first thing to come out of our mouth. Not always to act on the first impulse that comes out of our mouth. Because we can be driven by other things, right? My bent is and we used to call it a prophetic bent when we talk about giftings and such like that. Okay, a prophetic in this sense means to want to correct. The prophet calls people to change their ways and make them more in line with God's expectations. That's what a prophet does. And so many people who have very prophetic type ministry or prophetic type talking are people who oftentimes see, and when they encounter a situation of desperation, sometimes the first thing that comes to their mind is, what have you been doing wrong? What do you need to change? And I think if you would just smarten up, you wouldn't have found yourself in this position to begin with. Okay? And many of us, some of you identify, because that's, you know, your go-to is to bring some sense of correction to the situation. That can be an impulse that we have. But you know, when a person is in desperation, they don't need immediately to be corrected. They don't need to be figuring out why they got to that place to begin with. That's not the paramount need at the moment. Other influences can be fear, not knowing. Some of you could be bound up with fear because your immediate thought is, I am out of my element because I don't know what to do. I have no idea how to handle the situation, and fear comes on you, and you say, and you would avoid it, maybe run away, maybe hide. You see that person coming and you sneak out the other door because you know they're desperate, and I don't think I want to deal with that. And fear can hit you. Contempt can happen. Sometimes we can look at people and we can say, you know what, you did it to yourself. It's your own fault. You're desperate. You're losing your home because you failed to budget and look after your money right, or you were not working, or something, you know, and we can oftentimes blame, and then we can look with contempt and say, you know, you kind of had it coming. You almost want to say, I told you so. And those are the kinds of reactions we can bring into a situation, and we really have to stop and go, is this the right time? Some of it can just be plain selfishness. And it kind of affects all of these things, which is just, I don't feel like dealing with your desperation. This is going to take my time. This is going to derail me. This might even cost me money. This could get messy. I don't want to deal with that. I just can't be bothered. That's just selfishness, right? And that can direct us in how we approach things. And so all those kinds of things are drumming around. And what I'm saying is what we need to pull out in the moment of encountering desperation is, number one, compassion. Just imagine for a moment what they're going through. Don't worry about how much money you can afford to help them with. Don't worry about whether you have no idea what to say to them. Don't worry about any of those things. Just stop for a moment and say, they must be going through an awful lot. Wow, they must be hurting bad right now. And just have a moment of compassion with them. And then lastly, I want to encourage you to call you to trust God. Trust God. You need to call people in moments of desperation to trust in God. You know, it's possible to be a good counselor, lift the spirits of those in desperation. It's possible to practice compassion. Calmness. Those are things you could probably get at any university training on psychology or counseling, on the things that are needed for the moment. But we're Christians, and we're trying to respond to this from a biblical perspective. And so we ask ourselves, how does our faith play into this encounter? That's the crux of the matter for us. How does our faith? Well, first of all, let me just point out and remind you that your faith should help you with the first two elements. Calmness is found in the security of knowing who you are and where you're going. And Christians should be experts at being calm because we know who we are. We know whose we are. We're the child of the King, and nothing can change that. We can lose all our money and still say, praise God. Naked I came into this world, and naked I shall return. Praise be to God. You know, that's the kind of attitude it exudes out of Christians because we've learned to recognize that God has eternal perspective. The worst thing that could happen to me here is death. But death is only the gateway to eternal life with Christ. So death doesn't even hold a sting anymore to me. So therefore, who can play the calmness card better than a Christian? At least we should be. We should be experts at that ability to have calmness. And the second is compassion. Is that not a trademark for Christian people? Was it not even something Jesus said when he said, this shall all men know that you are my disciples because you have love for one another? Compassion? There's a certain element of grace and mercy that we have for each other, that we can help each other, encourage each other. And it's proved true around the world. Who leads the way in exercising social justice? Who leads the way in providing crisis relief? Christians, the Christian faith and people of the Christian faith are extremely motivated to want to go to the ends of the earth and provide relief for famine, for earthquakes, for sex trafficking and poverty and abuse and neglect, all those things that Christians rise up and say, we have to do something about this. There's a compassion. It's the compassion of Christ. The more we know Christ, the more his compassion comes out, and we're able to excel in these areas. So if you encounter desperate times, it's not just going to be drumming up your own calmness and your own compassion. It's going to be rooted in your relationship with Christ, and his calmness and his compassion is going to shine through you. Definitely. But the third element is very distinct in our Christian faith, and that is calling people to faith in God. Counselors may say, well, it could work out. Well, let's see what happens. Hey, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You know, all kinds of platitudes we can say. But really, it's the Christian who can say, God is on the throne. Jesus died for our sins. God is one day going to make everything right. He's going to wipe away every tear from our eye. He's going to introduce us to the glories of heaven. He will eradicate sin. He will eradicate the enemy. He will eradicate death. And we will live with eternal joy forevermore. That is the Christian message. And we call people to that message. You live that message. And when people are in desperate times, you have the opportunity to speak that into people's life and to call them to it. That's pretty bold speech. Jesus looks at him and says, go. And that word go is used numerous times in the New Testament. And it's not go like, get out of here. It's not go, you know, I can't be bothered with you. It's actually just a call to, you know what, go about your day. Go about your day. In other words, back to, you know, don't get so rattled. I want you to just go, make your way home. Your son is going to be healed. Your son is going to be healed. Wow, those are bold words to say. And I can just imagine how nervous this guy was. But Jesus calls him to trust him. And the text tells us that the man believed. He trusted Jesus. And he said, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to put my trust in God. And come on, guys, we're going to head back. Now, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's not till the next day that he runs into the servants. So obviously the journey is of enough distance that he can't get home that night. And so he decides, okay, let's check into a hotel. Let's get an inn. Let's go to our friend's place there. We'll crash for the night. We'll do this. And in the morning, we'll head back and we'll see what's coming. And so with great, I'm sure, patience, he decides to stick around the next morning, head home. Jesus calls out to him a miracle. Are you calling people? What are you, when you have a desperate situation, are you bold enough to call people to have trust in God? Sometimes that's the struggle we have, is I say, oh, I got to call people to have trust. Trust in him. There are those who see and they believe. And in this case, we heard this Jesus make that statement. You guys need to see a miracle to believe one, don't you? And he's okay. Your son is going to live. Off he goes. And then as the story goes, John says this was the second miracle. In other words, these are miracles. John's testifying of them. And the story, why is John doing this? The story leads up to this story in John chapter 20. And if you go to that scripture there, it says, he talks to Thomas. And he says, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. So the call here is at the end of John's gospel, John makes a point talking about miracles, talking about witnessing to what God does. If you put your trust in God, this is what you can expect. This is how he rewards those who have faith. These are the miracles I, John, saw and give testimony of. And then he says to his readers, keep in mind, John's got readers. These are people who did not live his life, who have only heard about Jesus. They did not meet Jesus. They did not see him. They just heard stories about them. But John says, listen, it's tough to believe in God. And even Jesus himself said, you need to see to believe, don't you? And at the end of the story, this phrase comes back again in the story of Thomas when he's doubting the resurrection. And Jesus says to him, come on, put your hands in my side. Look at my hands. I know you need to see to believe. I need you to look here. And Thomas believes. And Jesus said to him, I'm glad you believe. But Thomas, you've seen and believed. But blessed are those who don't see and believe. Right? Because that's the bulk of us. And then he goes on. The very next verse in this context is this. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of those. These are written, but are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have new life in his name. The whole context of the book of John was to help people who have never seen miracles, never met Jesus, to be able to put their faith in God. They're being called to put their faith in God. And John says, yes, this is not easy to do because you're going to ask somebody who doesn't see the result of the miracle or doesn't see at this point, where's Jesus? Why doesn't he visit me personally? And you say, I'm just going to tell you this. He is real. He's real in my life. He has done numerous miracles. I'm telling you this. He can raise the dead. He can raise the dead. He can deliver you. He can put a check in the mail that's going to show up tomorrow that's going to take care of all your financial problems. God can do that, can't he? When we're talking to desperate people, do we have a belief that God does miracles, that he's the way maker, promise keeper, miracle worker? This is who he is. That's who we believe in. When you meet with desperate people, the number one ace in the sleeve, the number one element you can do is you can call people to trust God. Now, I'm not going to say you're going to tell them every time, go, your son is alive. Go, the check will be in the mail. Go. In the numerous accounts of the scriptures, we see a variety of responses, but the same situations in all of them. You need to put your faith in God, that he will reward you in this life and in the life to come. He will be there for you. And we have seen that with people, even Christians who have died of cancer, Christians who have died early and died young, and people that have experienced pain in their family, and people say, but God didn't do the miracle. And they say, God was with me. God is with me. He's making the difference in my life. I have peace despite this circumstances. And that's, we hold out to people the hope that if you trust in God, it will work out. Will my son live? I can't answer that question. Now, if you have faith and God gives you the gift of faith at that moment or the gift of miracles, then by all means, pray and speak life into that person. Right? But ultimately, the trust is in God and saying whether he does or whether he doesn't, we're going to believe in God. We're going to trust in him. That's what we do to people who are desperate. We call them to have faith in God. In this story, the man did. The man had faith and he saw how God was at work and he came to, he and his whole family got saved. And I believe that you can be a ministering agent of God's love and compassion to people by going and meeting them. And when you see that desperation, when you encounter desperation, don't be afraid. Don't run away. Be calm. Be compassionate. And whether you know anything of what to do or how to speak into the situation, just say, you know what? I have no clue what to do in this circumstance. It sounds like maybe you need to talk to a doctor, or it sounds like maybe you need to talk to a debt expert. It sounds like maybe you need to talk to a counselor. It sounds like maybe you need to talk to somebody. Some things I don't know, but I know this. My God is real, and he can make a difference here, and I'm willing to pray with you right now if you want. I'm willing to just believe that God can deliver us. Call people to faith. Call them to trust in God. Now, I'm talking about unbelievers, okay? Call them to faith in God. I would give you other little tips, like, you know, I said vulnerable, right? And I said that they're at a crossroads, so don't abuse it. Don't call people to faith in an arrogant manner without compassion. Don't call people to faith in God without first listening to them. You know, don't call people to faith that give you no permission. There's this little thing called permission where people will look at you and you can tell that they want to know what you think. They ask you, what do you think? And on those things, you can say, listen, I don't know how interested you are in spiritual matters, but I want you to know that faith is crucial to me. And I genuinely believe God is on the throne in heaven above, and he cares about your life. He cares about my life. And my advice to you would be that you should have faith in God. That's the way you exercise that. And if a person says, I don't want any of that God stuff, then you say, well, I don't know how much I can offer you then, because my number one advice is to trust God in these circumstances. You know, but I certainly will pray for you on my own later if you like, and yeah, that's fine. Like, you respond to people, but you're still finding a way to call people to have faith in God. I'm going to invite the worship team to come on back. And I, as we close, I haven't necessarily been preaching this series because I want all those who are desperate you know, to speak to you. I'm actually speaking to you believers, saying you're going to encounter desperate people, and I want you to go in this week. I want you to go and have courage to minister to them. But I recognize that desperation is something we're familiar with, and some of you might be sensing that desperation. I want you today to trust God. And as we sing this song, I want you to just surrender that to God. Say, God, I will go about my way. I'm going to go out of here, and I'm going to go on with my day, and I'm going to put my trust in you.